Hey y'all, it's Lauren. Throughout this season, we have introduced you to small urban farmers, people working on the ground to change their environment, politicians working to pass environmental legislation, and more. But there are also many environmental scholars working to provide a space for Black environmentalists to thrive, which is why we are introducing you to Dr. Dorcida Taylor, an author and professor at the Yale School for the Environment. Ever since she was a young girl, growing up in Jamaica, she understood the value of having a fruitful environment.
I was really into this idea of paying attention to the environment. We had about a half an acre that was just roses. So the slave owners and their still white and mostly brown children, they were into roses from England and Scotland. And so when they came to Jamaica, they propagated these amazing rose bushes. And my task from the time I could walk was to tend the rose garden. So I really started to hone in on the pink, different shades of red that the rose bushes would have. And these things were huge because we were high up in the mountains, perfect temperature for growing roses. It didn't get very hot, lots of rainfall, but I would spend just hours out in that garden trying to notice the different kinds of species of roses we had. Didn't know the names, but starting to key in on differences. From that garden, I could look to the adjoining hillside and the waterfall that would come cascading down that mountainside was just, you know, I could hear it, I could see it. I was just in my zone out there. The wildflowers, I started to pay attention to the butterflies. We had over, you know, maybe about 10 different species of oranges, about 25, 30 different species of mangoes, cashews, bananas, you name it, pineapples, lemons, limes, different peas. I started to pay attention to those things. So that early time period in our life, we didn't have a lot of actual money, but what we had was wealth in terms of what was in the ground.
Dr. Taylor grew up in rural Jamaica in the 60s, a time when many young girls were left at home to help with chores and support the family, leaving education on the back burner.
So I literally did not go to school, and it's not because my mom didn't want to send me to school. She had just recently been separated from my father. She's now a married woman living away from her husband with four children. My older sister was sent to school. I was kept home to take care of my younger brother and sister. So I didn't walk into a schoolroom till I was almost 7 years old. When I walked into that classroom, there were 69 other children, and we were rank ordered from smartest to dumbest. Guess who got put in the number 70 slot? That was me, because I walked into the classroom not even knowing my proper name. I couldn't spell, I couldn't read, I couldn't write. I promptly went home after the first day of school and said to my older sister, the teacher said something about an alphabet. Could you write it out for me? Sound out the words, and I need to learn it. So night one, learn the alphabet. Day two, learn to spell every word I could find and think of. So I taught myself to read and write.
She dove headfirst into her studies, and when the British education system forced her to choose between the arts and sciences, she chose science because it was important to her. It wasn't until she went to college in the U.S. that she learned about the misconception that Black people don't care about the environment.
Then sitting in that environmental studies class, the first one, I noticed I was the only non-white student in the course. Coming from Jamaica, where in any school, no matter how small, how run down you are, you go into any kind of science course, course with environment, course with botany, zoology, and it's all Black kids in there. Black kids, the mixed race Indian kids, the mixed race Chinese kids, but we're not afraid of the sciences. We do it and we excel at it. So it was the biggest culture shock to me coming in an American classroom, where all of a sudden I'm sitting in a class where we're studying all the stuff about the environment, and not just I was the only black kid, the only non-white student in this class of about 50. And so two mistakes I made there, but those mistakes completely changed my career. Was I asked the professor, and I said, why aren't there any more black students in the course? Because we were learning all this really interesting stuff about pesticides in Africa, poisoning the water. We were just starting to look at pesticides in the US. This is something as black people we need to know. What am I doing wrong that I'm the only one in this class? Where are all the other black people? The prof, in front of the entire class of 50-something students, says back to me, "Black people are not interested in the environment. That's why you're the only one here." And I thought, in typical Jamaican fashion, thought but didn't say. I filtered myself that day. I said, I thought to myself, idiot. As classes ended, I marched over to the library. I pulled every article I could on environment and anywhere it would say black or so. And every single article said exactly what he said. Black people don't know about the environment and they don't care about the environment. So, someone like myself with an alternate reality of having got a distinction mark in zoology from the Cambridge University and Oxford boards, those are the hardest entrance exams in the world. How could I not know anything about the environment? And all my other peers all over the Caribbean that have done this, where did this perception come from? So I started to think, is this just an American thing? What is wrong with these people? How can people not care about the environment? All my life told me that was wrong. And so it absolutely changed my trajectory. I then decided I wasn't going to continue majoring in zoology and botany. I was going to shift focus and really start looking at this environmental piece. But also now it became my mission to discredit this notion that because you are black, you have no interest in the environment, you don't care about it, and you don't know anything about it.
Dr. Taylor has become a staple in the environmental community through her years of research and dedication to improving the overall success of students of color in environmental studies. And her work has unmasked the stereotypes of black folks and revealed their massive contribution to the environmental justice movement. So in this episode, we hear more about Dr. Taylor's work in environmental studies, the contributions black folks have made to the environmental justice movement, and the power community leaders hold in transforming the environments they live in. From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here. Education is an important part of Dr. Taylor's life. After receiving her Master's of Forestry from Yale University, she continued on that path of excellence, becoming the first African American woman to earn a doctoral degree in forestry and environmental science from Yale. But the road to get there was no easy journey.
The first semester I came out here to Yale, I came out here with no money. I literally drove a car. My daughters, I have twin daughters, they've said to me, "Mom, are you crazy? What if you had run out of gas between Chicago and New Haven, Connecticut?" And I said to them, sometimes when you want something bad enough, you don't think of those possibilities. Because until they said it to me, I had not thought about what if I had run out of gas. Because I literally had just enough money to put gas in the car to get me to New Haven. I couldn't even sleep in a hotel. I slept in a rest stop This is a 17-hour drive, and I was driving it by myself. Got to New Haven with virtually no money in my pocket and lived for about the first 4 months with no money. But how do you do it? It's Yale. There is a talk on campus at any hour of the day or night, or day particularly. At 4 p.m., there is always some major keynote address, and there is food there. So go there, learn to eat really nice cheeses, eat really fancy crackers, and get educated while you're at it. But have, that was dinner for September, October, into early November. And nobody knew I was starving. But my sense now is I pulled that off. Other students shouldn't have to pull that off. So I make sure they're taken care of. I didn't leave Yale because I thought, being that the school I was brought into, the school, it was then the School of Forestry, I was only the second Black woman in its entire history to have been admitted into that school. There were about maybe five Black men, all from Africa, who had been admitted before me. I had no money to go back to Chicago and to drive back to Chicago. So end of story there. But just in case I was dumb enough to contemplate the thought, no one would have said she left the school because she had no money and she was starving, right? They would have said she left the school because she couldn't cut it. And would they have admitted any additional Black students? Probably not. Because if the first one or the first two fail, we know how this narrative works. And so now I toughed it out. I went to a lot of really good lectures. And some of those lectures are very pivotal in me then deciding to stay on here and do my PhD, because I was learning more than I'd ever learned in my life in terms of just how that space opens up these incredible worlds of thinking, of learning. You're amongst these incredibly smart students. I wanted to be in that space, hungry or not.
The hardships she experienced motivated her to build a strong foundation of funding and support for the next generation of environmental conservation students to focus solely on learning rather than surviving at the same time. She provides undergraduate and graduate students with the opportunity to participate in an environmental conservation fellowship.
They now come to Yale in the summer to work with the professors, get an internship. I provide a really nice stipend. I provide all the students need so that, because one thing I'm passionate about helping, but I'm also passionate that other people shouldn't have to do it the hard way that I had to do it. So as long as students are passionate about the work, as long as they're willing to work hard and do good work and get good grades, I'm there to be their champion and their advocate to help them to make that next step. So by myself, I found 75 to 78 students for summer opportunities, because those opportunities are still not as open to Brown and Black people in the environmental sector as they should be. And people need help.
As Dr. Taylor works to provide opportunities that she never had to the next generation of environmental students, she remains grounded by her years of research on why Blacks were not considered environmentalists and the reason for the lack of opportunities today. That's why in her 2016 book, The Rise of the American Conservation Movement, Power, Privilege, and Environmental Protection, she spent a lot of time recounting the contributions Black folks made to the movement.
To call out these things that we've done and contributed and these experiences that are very valid, but because they don't have that label on them, environment. Even if you go to the civil rights movement, when Rosa Parks says, I'm not going to the back of the bus, I'm sitting on the front of the bus, we now have a label for that. It's called transportation justice. But back in the 60s or 50s, we were calling it just civil rights. But she was articulating a right to a just and equal transportation system where, because of her skin color, she should not be sent to the back of the bus. We also now know that the back of the bus is one of the worst places for people. That's where most of the pollution in those old buses are, in the very back of the bus. If you're on the front of the bus, that door is opening and closing, especially if you're sitting by the door. It's letting out whatever little pollution comes up there. But it's in the back where the fumes are. Because if you think of a bus, a lot of the mechanism is in that very back part of it, right? So even without knowing that we're also subjecting ourselves to environmental injustices on the back of the bus, we instinctively knew it probably wasn't the best place for us, right? I talk about someone like Harriet Tubman. And for Harriet Tubman to do what she did on the Underground Railroad, she had to have been an incredible environmentalist to know how to navigate in the dark, know the trees, know the herbs. Again, getting back to that connection to your nature, know what foods she could find along the way to guide these slaves. I talk about Phyllis Wheatley and her poetry all the way back in the 1700s. If we look at her work, Phyllis Wheatley is one of the first person in America, black, brown, white, pink, or whatever color, to start to talk about the environment in this positive tone. And most people who do environmental history credit the people who told us, stop degrading the environment, stop cutting down all the trees, value the trees. Those folks were the beginning parts of the early environmental movement. Well, Phyllis Wheatley, a slave in Boston, precedes them almost by 100 years in her writings.
Through this book, she takes us on a journey where we discover that most Blacks were not considered participants in the environmental movement just for simply not naming it.
There were a lot of activists in Chicago, New York City, in the 60s, civil rights movement again, talking about lead poisoning, the poisoning of Black children in the public housing projects. Again, they didn't use the word environmental justice. It wasn't around. But today we know that's environmental justice and health. And so a lot of young folks need to go back into those histories, talk to their families, talk to find out about their loved ones, and write these things down. There are now very too few of us who are doing that work. We just need a lot more. And stop waiting for white people to recognize what we do, how we do it, and tell our stories for us. They can't tell the story of me and the communities I've grown up with, or communities I'm familiar with, or the way I see things, the way I can do it. So we have to do that. I mean, you're asking me very different questions and framing it in very different ways and getting me to talk about very different things than white journalists do when they interview me. So we need to be in the space much more.
And instead of just talking about being in that space, she built one. The New Horizons in Conservation Conference took place in April, where hundreds of people of color discussed the environment.
So when people are saying we don't exist, we're not in the field, they can't find us to hire us. Part of what I just demonstrated again was that is simply not the case. If we can get that many hundreds of environmental activists, climate activists, environmental justice activists, conservationists of color to spend 3 days on these topics, it tells us that we're actually making progress. But we simply can't be just reactive. We now need to be writing our own stories. If we don't write our stories, they get distorted. And we need to stop ourselves. Because if you look at most of the civil rights narratives, they're framed as civil rights. They don't put that environmental piece. So desegregating the beaches and the parks, you know, Martin Luther King Jr., a lot of other civil rights activists went and did that in the 60s and 70s. But it's up to us to go pull those pieces of history together and connect. So we talk a lot about intersectional work. We ourselves need to do those intersectional pieces.
During the conference, a main point of discussion was the connection between COVID-19 and the environments in which we live in, and how history shows us that Black people have been consistently placed in unhealthy environments where they cannot survive.
One of the things that came up a lot in the conference I just finished was, you know, the why so many Black and Brown people in the inner city got sick with COVID and died from COVID. One of the things that's coming out now from the environmental justice research and the mapping is the fact that COVID adheres, sticks to these very small particulate matter. Those are usually air pollution particles, these very small PM2.5. The areas in the country where we find the highest rate of those kinds of air pollution are in Black communities and Latinx communities. And these are the areas, because the COVID sticks to those particles, you breathe them deep into your lungs. So it's not because we're dumb. It's not because we were out partying while we were getting COVID. It's not because we were careless or we didn't have masks. It's what we were breathing. And when you're now looking at the maps of the COVID hotspots that really affected, especially Black communities, when you overlay that on the maps of the highest air pollution areas, the maps of highest rates of Black asthma in the country, the maps of segregated, redlined communities, and I talk about that in toxic communities, you see these maps are overlaying in a way that is just shocking. Maps of the heat strokes, like in places like Chicago, where 742 people, mostly Black, died on the South Side in these areas that were redlined, segregated, don't have air conditioning, don't have energy efficiency. We're seeing COVID now play out on top of that.
Dr. Taylor says we have to be more present in environmental spaces and conversations because the effects of the pandemic have proven we can no longer overlook the environmental issues communities of color are facing.
We don't have the privilege of excusing ourselves from caring, because while we're not at the zoning board meetings, while we're not paying attention to those things, guess whose neighborhood is going to get the next junkyard, the next waste dump, the next factory that's going to spew more of this air pollution, this PM2.5. And then, you know, we're dealing with COVID and we're dealing with COVID in a vacuum, not realizing how it's overlaying on these other environmental injustices. So birds and trees, what people are finding out now, if you live in many cities, your air temperature is about 10 to 15 degrees higher than in parts of the city that have trees. So we better start caring about that treescape. And so it's not an either or. It really is, how do you understand how they're connected so that we actually can live and breathe and have our children have neighborhoods in which they can drink water, breathe the air, sit and rest, and, you know, those things together. Not an option for us. And if we're not at the table with when all of these discussions are going down, we're on the menu, people.
The notion that Black people do not care about the environment or aren't involved in the movement is simply not true. And Dr. Taylor, among many others, have made it their mission to promote and uplift people of color in this space. So how can we connect this larger issue to our region? And what ways can people on the ground in the midst of it all do to build a better environment for the next generation? Up next, we hear how Dr. Taylor has connected her courses on environmental racism to our region and how the new administration can help support the communities hit the hardest with environmental issues. We have always said that we see St. Louis as a backdrop to the larger issues we see in our country, and environmental racism is no different. So when I sat down with Dr. Taylor to discuss her work, I wondered how much she knew about a specific place in the St. Louis region, East St. Louis. And in a previous episode of We Live Here, Boots to the Streets, we discussed how the City of Champions is a prime example of environmental racism. This is why Dr. Taylor says she starts her course, Poverty, Environment, and Inequality, discussing the history of East St. Louis.
Everybody knows a lot about Detroit, Harlem, you know, Houston, Baltimore, Philadelphia, those big cities, but smaller deindustrialized cities like East St. Louis gets put under the radar. A lot of people don't know. And with East St. Louis, they really epitomize the challenges of when you have a very low income community, very limited tax base, but also a community where organizing is still in its infancy. Even though some of the groups there have been around for two or three decades, it takes a lot of community organizing to get these brownfield sites and Superfund sites cleaned up. Why? Part of what happens is decisions are made in some of the local zoning boards and in some of the state level. Communities have to first recognize there is a toxic site there.
Community activists and leaders have to put in a lot of effort to contact the EPA and potentially clean up an area. But what about those people who aren't on the front lines of challenging systems? In Dr. Taylor's 2014 book, Toxic Communities, Environmental Racism, Industrial Pollution, and Residential Mobility, she discussed the willingness to pay versus environmental trade-off thesis. The thesis assumes that people who are unwilling to pay for safer, more expensive housing are trading off living with higher risk for more affordable housing, meaning those who are able to move out do, leaving those who are not able to behind. But Dr. Taylor says we can no longer afford to make the trade-off.
For us Black folks, we cannot make this distinction between I have to feed my family and I have to take care of my necessities. I can't be bothered with those things. You have to be bothered with those environmental things if, again, you want to live long enough to enjoy the meals that you're providing for your family and to enjoy a healthy life. Because while we are not at the zoning board meeting, the city council meeting, while we're not monitoring the environment, East St. Louis, there are grammar schools literally across the street from some of these toxic sites. Have anybody connected the dots between academic performance and being so close to these sites? It's not that Black children are dumb. It's these other factors that are getting in the way of their education. And so while we're busy thinking, you know, I just have to focus on getting the kids to school, getting them dressed, having a job that will feed them, these other things are luxuries. No, they're not. If we look at the childhood cancer rate, East St. Louis doesn't even have a hospital in it. And so we have to understand how these dots are connected. We have to then connect that to our electoral politics. Elect people from your district who are going to go to Congress and push for cleanup. Because the other thing we know is if you are in a community where your congressional representative pushes the EPA to clean up the toxic site in your neighborhoods, guess what? They get cleaned up faster, they get more dollars for cleanup, and they get better remediation. So we have to understand that also, how to connect it with politics, vote out the people who are in the hip pocket of the industries, put people in who are going to fight for those kinds of cleanup. And we're seeing this happen where, you know, more and more of the representatives and senators going into Congress where people of color are tying their votes to the environmental performances in their district, are really paying attention to environmental injustices. It's a good moment now for community organizers to really understand, you know, if you have somebody representing you, go to their next election campaign and let them know that how you're going to be voting is you're going to be voting on EJ, environmental justice.
As more and more people of color are represented in our government, the more opportunities we have to get legislation passed to support our communities. Specifically with the new administration, President Biden's Justice 40 initiative plans to deliver 40% of climate investment benefits to disadvantaged communities.
What that is going to do is put money in low-income communities, to the communities that are the frontline communities, what we call the sacrifice zones, the communities like East St. Louis that have borne the brunt of the environmental inequalities, to knock down those hideous brownfields, clean them up, you know, rebuild the main street, get fresh, healthy grocery stores, farmers market. There is a ton of money that's going to be coming down the pike for those things. The communities that don't have people advocating to bring the money into the low-income brown communities, those communities will get nothing. The money will then go to the privileged communities, or to the industrial sector, or to, you know, large-scale white farmers rather than small owner black farmers or black community gardens. So we got to get involved. And we don't have some of that infrastructure because we haven't been at the table. We haven't gone to the zoning board. And there is a kind of terminology emerging in environmental justice around the infrastructure gap or the infrastructure justice. So we've had transportation justice, energy, the shutoffs, the fact that people of color homes are without heat in the winter and air conditioning in the summer and electricity. But we also have an infrastructure gap where Black and Latinx and Native communities, a lot of them don't even have the pipes to run the sewer out their home. There are many places in the U.S. where Black and brown people don't have running water in their homes. Again, we have to understand that these are huge inequities. So we have to be very aware of all of these things, that they are connected. We simply cannot afford not to do environment. That is just not an option anymore. It never should have been an option, but it definitely isn't an option.
And as she continues to teach and provide opportunities in the environmental space, the hope for a more peaceful, beautiful, and just world keeps her going.
Fair, equitable, just environment. And that might sound simple, but if it's equal, if it's equitable, then my child, your child, the child of our brown and white friends would have the same ability to have the same access to excellent education. So that's one thing, because education is a driver for so many other things. Everybody should be able to breathe fresh air. We know how to do it. It is absolutely possible. And anybody who thinks this is trivial, go on a mountaintop or a hillside or go to a rural area and breathe as deeply as you can. And you understand the beauty of how that can remove the stress, remove the tension. You can feel your body responding to that. And I'd love everybody at some point in their life to be able to be in a place, even if it's not every day, that you can just go in and just listen to the sound of silence, see beauty, be able to watch a bird, just be at the flower and watch that happen. So that's something I'd like to see. Definitely everybody having access to a job that pays them enough to live at the level they want to live. We don't all have to be millionaires and trillionaires. What we all should have is enough that we can have a decent living that we feel proud of and we respect for ourselves. So if we all can have those things, education, a decent living, access to definitely fresh water, the ability to have a place that is yours. You can call that home. And again, this is America. America has the capacity, as we speak, to house every single person living in this country. Again, it doesn't have to be a 40-bedroom mansion, but we have the money and the ability to put a roof over every person's head in this country. And if we can do that, then so many other things fall in place. That now we're spending money on the back end to spend over $100,000 to incarcerate kids, you know, for stealing a candy or for smoking a few ounces of marijuana, yet we cannot provide that child with a house that probably could cost $40,000 or $50,000. You think about it, you know, we're not doing that. And then that equality, equity piece that you and I and everybody that look like us should be able to walk down the road and not expect to be shot 10 times in the back, front, side, head, wherever. We should be able to drive our cars and not have to worry that, oh my God, I hope somebody doesn't pull me over. And if the cops pull me over, am I going to get 10 bullets before I have a chance to say good morning or something like that? To be seen for who we are, not for our skin color. And why does our skin color still matter so much? So if we could ever get past the point of treating every other person as a human being, as somebody like us, in the way we want to be treated, if we could ever do that, that would be so fundamentally radical that it, you know, it would blow our minds. If we could simply get to that point where we can do that and just simply not have this notion that simply because of somebody's skin color, in a person of another race has the ability to step on them, stomp on them, shoot them, kill them, throw them out of a job, throw them out of school, body slam. You send your young black daughter to a school and a white cop comes in and body slams her. Why? Because she's not sitting on the chair properly. So my ultimate wish would be that we have a world, not just a society, a world in which we understand that that equality and equity means that we stop seeing skin color and treating it in this very different way that we now do.
This show is produced by me, Lauren Brown, and lead producer Jolianne Yang. Research materials for this episode come from Dr. Taylor's 2014 book, Toxic Communities: Environmental Racism, Industrial Pollution, and Residential Mobility. One more note before we go. St. Louis Public Radio is looking into racially restrictive covenants and deeds in the St. Louis region. In the early to mid-1900s, white homeowners and realtors commonly used these tools to keep black people out of certain neighborhoods. If you live in an old home, check your records. They might have clues that could help inform our reporting. Look through your real estate documents for restrictions on who can own it and live there. You can find more information on how to share those documents and your stories with us on our website at stlpr.org/housingdiscrimination. St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri St. Louis. From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.